This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 10th, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, in Michigan, labor advocates continue to fight GOP efforts to rush through right-to-work legislation. A final vote could come Tuesday. Demonstrators in the UK fight a program that requires people to work for free in order to receive benefits. And immigration advocates in Canada mark International Human Rights Day by drawing attention to the country's harsh treatment of migrants and asylum seekers. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. There are conflicting reports today about who died in an apparent drone strike Sunday in Pakistan's tribal areas. Unnamed Pakistani intelligence officials say the wife and son of Taliban commander Mohammed Ahmed al-Mansur died along with him, but a Taliban commander says that the dead were all militant fighters. Al-Mansur was reportedly linked to another high-level al-Qaeda figure killed by drone fire late last week in the same area. Abdel Rahman al-Husseinin died Thursday. His wife also died, and his child was injured. After weekend elections, the head of Ghana's main opposition New Patriot Party, or NPP, said today that they will challenge the results in court, citing voter fraud. Yesterday, the head of the country's Electoral Commission announced the official outcome.
Based on the results given, I declare John Dramani Mahama president-elect.
According to election officials, National Democratic Congress incumbent President Mahama won with almost 51%. About 48% voted for the opposition NPP's Nana Akufo-Addo. Turnout was 80%. Voting was extended to Saturday after electronic fingerprint readers malfunctioned. In Egypt today, the military assumed partial control of security after President Mohamed Morsi issued an edict yesterday granting them power to arrest civilians. And state council judges have reversed course, now agreeing to monitor Saturday's referendum on a proposed constitution, but only if officials prevent voter intimidation at polling sites and provide the judges life insurance. They also want an end to the Muslim Brotherhood-backed sit-in outside the constitutional court. Saturday, President Morsi canceled his controversial decree that placed him outside judicial reach and sparked deadly outrage. Today, Morsi canceled another decree within hours of issuing it. This one hiked taxes on a variety of goods and services. More major protests are expected tomorrow. Protests erupted in India's parliament today when lawmakers discovered how much money Walmart spent on lobbying, some of which targeted opening the country's doors to foreign retail. Bismillah Gilani reports.
As soon as the parliament convened today, opposition members in the upper house shouted demands for an inquiry into reports that Walmart has spent huge money for getting access to India's retail markets. In quarterly reports required by the US, Walmart disclosed that since 2008, it has spent $25 million on lobbying, including efforts to gain access to India's markets. In India, lobbying equals bribery and is illegal. Ravi Shankar Prasad is a senior leader with the main opposition Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP.
This is a clear case of bribery, and the government must now reveal who took the bribe. It is a very serious issue and puts a question mark on the entire process of opening up the retail sector.
Last week, the parliament approved the government's controversial decision allowing foreign multinational companies to enter India's retail sector. The opposition now wants a moratorium on that decision. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
A 16-year-old Tibetan girl died today after setting herself on fire. Wan Chin-chi was a middle school student in Qinghai, a northwestern province of China. Yesterday, in Sichuan province, a Buddhist monk and his nephew were arrested, charged with intentional homicide. According to state media, the two encouraged eight others to self-immolate in protest of Chinese rule and repression in Tibet. The acting director of women's affairs for Afghanistan's Laghman province was assassinated today. Najia Siddiqui was shot outside her home as she left for work. Siddiqui took over the post in July after her predecessor, Hanifa Safi, was also assassinated. During the last 24 hours in Washington state, hundreds of same-sex couples legally wed. Washington joins eight other states and the District of Columbia in recognizing same-sex marriage. FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield reports from Seattle.
Governor Christine Gregoire says she was proud to sign the state's new marriage equality law. It's the first same-sex marriage law in the nation to be passed by a state legislature and also approved by voters. Since December 6th, state officials have processed more than 1,000 new applications for marriage licenses. Yesterday, 142 marriage ceremonies were held at Seattle City Hall, and a major citywide celebration was organized at the Paramount Theater. Mayor Mike McGinn and other local government officials gathered to support the newlyweds. Local court judges agreed to volunteer their services in communities all across the state to accommodate the hundreds of new marriage applicants. Last month, voters in Washington, Maryland, and Maine approved ballot measures recognizing same-sex marriage. Washington will also recognize same-sex unions registered in other states. Although the U.S. federal government's Defense of Marriage Act outlaws gay marriage, last Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear two landmark cases involving marriage equality and claims of discrimination against same-sex couples. Justices will likely hear the case next March, with decisions expected in June. Mark Taylor Canfield, Free Speech Radio News, Seattle.
For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood, in Kansas City. A coalition of activists and lawmakers are in federal court today, challenging the constitutionality of the filibuster. The case comes as a bill to reform the filibuster is gaining support in the Senate. But the U.S. government wants the lawsuit thrown out, saying the plaintiffs have no standing to sue, and that the judicial branch would be encroaching on the Senate's powers if it struck the filibuster down. FSRN's Alice Olstein was at the court in Washington, D.C. this morning and brings us this report.
Plaintiffs claim that the DREAM Act, the Disclose Act, parts of the Affordable Care Act, and many other important bills have been blocked by the filibuster over the last 2 years, despite getting more than 50% of votes. But lawyers for the U.S. Senate told a district court judge on Monday that it's impossible to prove that those bills would have passed without the filibuster, because bills can also be killed in committee, blocked by the Senate Majority Leader, or simply voted down the old-fashioned way. Attorney Emmett Bondurant, who represented the organization Common Cause, countered that he doesn't have to prove certain bills would have passed, only that they were denied a fair process. His team argued that the court would not be violating the Senate's rights in letting this case go forward.
The Senate has a right to make its own rules, but its own rules cannot be unconstitutional.
That's Bob Edgar, a former Congress member and current president of Common Cause, the group spearheading the filibuster suit. They filed the motion earlier this year after a record number of bills, as well as several judicial nominations, were blocked from receiving a vote, even though more than half the Senate supported them.
We believe that the Constitution of the United States specifically states that the legislative branch of government, both the House and the Senate, should operate through majority rule. And our core argument is that that majority rule process is not permitted when you have to have a supermajority vote on almost every issue that comes before the United States Senate.
Joining Common Cause in the lawsuit are a handful of House Democrats who say their votes were nullified when the bills they helped pass got filibustered in the Senate. Three undocumented activists are plaintiffs as well, claiming injury from the filibustering of the DREAM Act in 2010. Erica Andiola, who was brought to the U.S. from Mexico by her parents, explained why she came out publicly as undocumented in order to support the legal challenge.
I am doing it because I do believe in the democracy of this country. If the American people actually support something like this, legislation like this one, they should pass, and unfortunately it didn't because of the filibuster.
As the parties in this case wait for the district court to announce whether or not it will throw out the lawsuit, a bill to make key reforms to the filibuster could come to the Senate floor. Republican leader Mitch McConnell has promised to do everything he can to block the legislation, which he says is aimed at disempowering Senate Republicans. But Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley, the main author of the reform bill, says the bill's goal is to enhance the transparency of the filibuster process by requiring lawmakers to justify their decision to block a bill on the Senate floor.
That is a hugely important because it takes away the frivolous filibuster, and it means that the public can weigh in on whether they think that the person is a hero or a bum. Otherwise, we just have bills being killed in the dark of night.
Among other reforms, the bill would force senators to publicly justify a filibuster and prove they have enough support to block a bill. It would also ban the minority party from filibustering the same bill more than once. Majority Leader Harry Reid has said he supports bringing the bill up for a vote as early as next month. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Michigan, union members and their supporters continue to protest against the Workplace Equity and Fairness Act. It's a package of so-called right-to-work legislation that opponents say is politically motivated and will give corporations more power to silence workers. Governor Snyder says the legislation is about workplace fairness and equity. As a prelude to larger union protests tomorrow, when lawmakers are expected to take up the bills again, this morning, nurses from the Michigan Nurses Association stood silent on the steps of the Capitol with duct tape covering their mouths. Jeff Breslin is a registered nurse and the association's president. He was at the protest and he joins me now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What exactly were you trying to say about this right-to-work legislation by covering your mouths in duct tape this morning?
Right-to-work takes our voices away in our workplace. I work as a registered nurse, and we need collective bargaining so that we can be able to have a say of how patients are taken care of. This is the beginning, basically, of a war on the middle class, where the politicians are trying to take away workers' rights, and they are trying to silence our voices in the workplace.
As a working nurse, how specifically would this legislation affect you?
Through collective bargaining, we have been able to establish minimum nurse-to-patient ratios so that each nurse has a limited number of patients that they take care of so that we have the ability to spend more time at the patient's bedside to make sure that they are taken care of safely, to make sure that they get the care that they deserve when they come in the hospital. Without collective bargaining, if you're running the hospitals like a business, they can give a nurse as many patients as what they see fit.
Tell us about today's scene at the Capitol. Who's protesting and what do opponents hope to accomplish?
Right now, there's not a lot of people at the Capitol. Tomorrow is really going to be the big day to see the numbers of people turn out. And the people that are there now are there to send a message similar to what I'm sending, that right to work is wrong for Michigan.
I understand there are three bills. What are the main differences between them?
The way that it is set up, workers in the public sector are different than the workers in the private sector, so that's why they had to split it up into three different bills.
What do you see as the main reasons why Republicans rushed through these bills and Governor Snyder's support, which you say is an abrupt change to how he recently regarded right to work?
In the state of Michigan, after the election that happens in November, until the new legislators, the new people who are elected, take office in January, there's what they call a lame duck session. We have several legislators that are still in their seats, but will not have a job in the legislature after January. So they're free to vote any way that they want to. They're getting huge political donations from big corporations, and they are doing their bidding without fear of repercussion because they've already been voted out of office.
Republicans also attached a $1 million appropriation to the bill, which means under state law it can't be subject to a voter referendum to overturn it. If it's passed, when lawmakers convene on Tuesday, what recourse do opponents have?
We will be looking at different legal recourse. We will be looking at anything that we can do to fix the situation. A lot of the lawmakers are up for election in 2014, and we will be keeping in mind how they voted during this right-to-work fiasco.
How do you convince people who may not like the idea of compulsory financial support to unions that that's necessary?
Right now, there is no obligation for anybody to join a union. The rhetoric that the right wing and the governor is putting out there is that when people go into a workplace where there is a union, they are obligated to join and obligated to be a member. The truth is, they are not. There are different ways that they can still work in that workplace and not be a member. What this right to work sets up is a situation where they can work there, enjoy the benefits of what the union has brought, but not have to pay for any of them. Similar to if I joined a country club that the governor belongs to, took advantage of all the services that they offered, but then said that I was not going to pay for any of it.
You have the support of some local faith leaders. The Reverend Greg Martin of the Unitarian Universalist Church was there with you on the Capitol's steps today. What did he say?
He's saying very similar to what we are, that, you know, the right to work is not only bad for Michigan workers, but it's bad for everybody in Michigan. It's bad for the economy. People in right-to-work states earn less than people in non-right-to-work states. And right now, Michigan's economy is struggling. We have just started to make a bit of a comeback, and this legislation is going to cut the legs out from underneath it. When people are making less, they're forced to buy the necessities, such as food and housing. They're not going to be spending money on any of the extras, which is going to affect a lot of the local businesses.
So what would you like to see happen now?
Right now, I would like to see the governor step forward and be the leader that he was put there to be and veto this legislation so that the state can continue to move forward with the economic recovery that we have started.
Jeff Breslin, president of the Michigan Nurses Association, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
I appreciate it. You have a great day.
To cut its national debt, the UK government has pledged to reduce the amount it spends on the welfare state. Last week, Britain's equivalent of Treasury Secretary, Chancellor of the Exchequer, announced major cuts to benefits for the unemployed, the sick, and people with disabilities. The government is also trying to get people off benefits and back into work with a controversial series of mandatory work schemes called Workfare. Since the schemes were introduced last year, tens of thousands of unemployed people have completed unpaid work placements for businesses and charities in return for their benefits. Over the weekend, anti-workfare protests were held in 8 cities. FSRN's Tom Allen went to one and files this report.
Protesters gather outside a charity shop in Leith, Edinburgh. The British Heart Foundation store sells second-hand furniture and electrical goods. After demonstrating outside, they decide they're going to occupy the shop. At first there's no resistance, but before long the police are called and they're ejected. So it's on to another store, and another. With dozens of charities and businesses involved in mandatory work schemes, there's no shortage of targets.
I'm certainly here as a worker because I realise this damages my terms and conditions.
Stephen didn't want to give his full name or where he works. But he says the programme erodes labour rights and fails to address long-term unemployment.
If the jobs aren't there, then, you know, a lot of people are having to, they're kind of staying on benefits because they've got no real choice.
Thousands of young unemployed people have been placed in a mandatory work scheme, including Callum Kenny. The idea is that they pick up skills and experience to help them get a job, but Kenny says he didn't acquire any relevant training during his 4 weeks in a charity shop.
All I ended up doing was sticking tags on clothes and sorting through clothes, saying what should be binned and what shouldn't. I'm not going to put that on my CV.
It doesn't look like you've chosen to do something to better yourself. It just looks like you didn't have a choice.
Not everyone on these placements is reluctant to be there. In a shop run by Cancer Research UK on the other side of town, Jade Clough is working on the till.
Well, I wanted to do hairdressing but I didn't like it, and then I went into retail and I came here and I actually liked it. I think I'm going to volunteer here.
Cancer Research UK is pulling out of mandatory work schemes in the new year because of public pressure. But Assistant Manager Kay Fairney thinks it's helped the 15 people who came through her store.
I think it's good. I think it's positive. And I think most people get quite a lot out of it. We have had people that have gone on to get employment and apprenticeships. And I think a lot of people, by working with the public and dealing with money and everything, become more confident and feel better about themselves and their chances of getting a job.
The problem for the government is that their own figures suggest that the $700 million Welfare to Work programme is failing. According to data from the Department of Work and Pensions, the companies participating in the programme have failed to meet the government's own low target of getting about 5% of people in the scheme into sustainable employment. But rather than scale back, the government's expanding mandatory work to include more people, those with disabilities.
Sterile dressings, TCP.
Lauren Stonebanks was a medical student when she had a breakdown 10 years ago. She's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and a borderline personality disorder. She's showing me her self-harm kit.
And scalpel. Cutting to a degree, yes, it does help. It's sort of temporary relief. And sometimes if I need to do something and I just, the anxiety's so bad, I don't think I'm going to be able to, cutting will give me just enough of a release to be able to achieve what I need to do that day.
Stonebanks says that she's recently started carrying the kit around again because of the stress and uncertainty of changes to her welfare support. She receives benefits as part of the work-related activity group, which includes about 340,000 people. People in this group receiving benefits must undertake a range of activities to help them get back into work, including interviews and training. Richard Hamer is Director of External Affairs at Capability Scotland, a charity working with people with disabilities.
When disabled people get forced into jobs, they tend to be unsuccessful jobs. It can be very difficult, not just because of physical difficulties, but also mental impairments, poor mental health, for example, for people to adapt to the work market and the labour market. If we start simply forcing people into jobs, then there's a high likelihood that the employer won't be the best solution for them.
Many people with disabilities want to find long-term employment, but accessibility can be a challenge. Susan Archibald is a disability rights campaigner. In 2004, she won an employment case at the House of Lords, changing the law so that employers must make reasonable adjustments for employees with disabilities.
Is the government going to stump up the money for to make every place accessible, for to give somebody a support worker, for to give them a driver? Oh, aye. If the government's going to give everybody access to work and pay for access to work, for help all these folk into compulsory employment as they speak, then maybe that wouldn't be so bad, but I can't see that happening.
Campaigners have pledged to continue targeting the businesses and charities involved in the mandatory work scheme. So far, the government has rejected criticism and vowed they will continue the programmes. Tom Allen, FSRN, Edinburgh.
December 10th is International Human Rights Day. To mark the day, activists in Canada are holding actions across the country against immigration detention and prisons. They're calling attention to new legislation set to take effect this week, which could lock up asylum seekers in much higher numbers. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff brings us this report from Montreal.
Demonstrators gathered in 8 Canadian cities over the last week to protest Bill C-31, as well as all other forms of immigration detention. The legislation goes into effect Saturday and will bring about sweeping changes to Canada's Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. The bill empowers the Immigration Minister to reject refugee claimants from so-called safe countries of origin and to order mandatory detention for irregular arrivals. Amy Darwish is a migrant justice activist with the People's Commission on Immigration Security Measures in Montreal.
You know, these are especially worrisome changes in the sense that, you know, what falls under irregular arrivals is a very, very vague term. That arriving as a refugee to some degree implies arriving by so-called irregular means. And so you're looking at an increasingly large number of people who are going to be finding themselves in detention for longer periods of time with very little review and, you know, very little recourse. And it's partly for this reason that we are demanding an end to detention and to free and freedom for all migrants.
Last week, Immigration Minister Jason Kenney held a press conference at the U.S.-Canadian border to announce that the government had apprehended 85 Romanian migrants who've been brought up to Quebec in vans from Cancun, Mexico. Activists are calling this a prelude to the detention of mass arrivals that could be brought in under Bill C-31. Even without the bill, the Canadian Border Services Agency says that in 2009, it held over 14,000 migrants in detention in its facilities. And in 2010, nearly 500 Tamil asylum seekers from Sri Lanka arrived by boat on British Columbia's coast and were immediately put into immigration detention. Lawmakers who support C-31 say it's needed to respond to human trafficking, bogus asylum claimants, and threats to national security. But some of those who've experienced Canada's detention system say lawmakers should be improving conditions for migrants instead. Sandrine Massoudom is a refugee from Cameroon living in Montreal. She says she was locked up for 4 days at the Laval Migrant Detention Center in 2009 with her son, who was 7 years old at the time. She was also 5 months pregnant.
I lived through a sad nightmare and a bad experience while I was there. People in the detention center are likened to criminals. The security guards are everywhere. There are surveillance cameras everywhere. Every time you go from one place or another, there are searches. Even when you are in the toilet, there's a security guard waiting for you at the door. There's a systematic confiscation of personal objects. There are certain women who are separated from their children, but that wasn't my case.
According to Canadian immigration authorities, there were 330 minors detained in 2010. Protesters across the country are also demanding an end to security certificates, which allow for perhaps the most extreme form of migrant detention in Canada. Security certificates are issued by the Minister of Immigration and allow for non-citizens to be detained indefinitely without trial and under secret evidence. The Supreme Court of Canada deemed the measure to be unconstitutional in 2006 and gave the government 1 year to rewrite the law. But when the government passed its new security certificate law, it only had minor changes that required a special advocate to review the secret evidence against the detainee. According to the Justice for Majoub Network, a support group for one of the security certificate detainees, there are currently 3 people still under security certificates in Canada, all of them Muslim Arab men. Mohamed Harkat, a refugee from Algeria, was arrested outside his home in Ottawa on a security certificate a decade ago on a suspicion he was part of a terrorist sleeper cell and that he allegedly trained in camps in Afghanistan run by Osama bin Laden. Monday marks the 10-year anniversary of his arrest. He spoke with FSRN by phone from his home on a line which he says is permanently tapped by the Canadian Secret Intelligence Service.
The process is unfair. It's inhuman and injustice. We're an open and democratic country, and people have a right to defend themselves, have a right to face the accuser, have a right to see all the evidence against them. We're just asking for a fair and open trial. You have to fight for a right.
Harkat was in prison from 2002 to 2006 and was released on strict bail conditions, which include him wearing a GPS tracking bracelet at all times. He was never formally charged of any crime, and ever since his arrest, Harkat denies any involvement with terrorist activities. Last month, the Supreme Court announced it would hear Harkat's appeal of his security certificate, but he still faces a possible deportation back to Algeria. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
That's it for the program today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.